We do have a ton to get through in this episode.
Common sense is finally prevailing.
There was controversy this month, Dave.
I'm not particularly excited by that.
Secrets and things on set.
I haven't told them anything.
I think this is just good times all round.
Every Doctor Who is liked by somebody, and that's a really good thing.
Dave-o, my Doctor.
I know we disagree on this one.
First world problems, Dave.
I get why fans are asking those questions.
Oh gosh, that's actually quite a lot to talk about.
Doesn't compute.
It's the elephant in the room.
That's okay.
Fandom versus the BBC.
The cardinal sin.
Moving along.
Lunch.
G'day, I'm Rob.
And I'm Dave.
And you're listening to the Doctor Who Show's April episode, where tonight, Dave, we'll be looking at the 1996 novel, Who Killed Kennedy?
We are. It's one that I've been keen to chat about for a while, and I don't think you needed much persuading, Rob.
No.
So I'm looking forward to this.
Me too. And if you're looking at your feed for the first time in maybe a week or two, you might notice a few days back we dropped a synopsis episode of Who Killed Kennedy. So if you've not read the book before, or you read it back in the 90s and you've forgotten half of the things that happened, have a listen to that 15 minutes or so of Dave and I just running through the plot, and it will bring you up to steam.
Or just dive in and see how you go.
Yes, it could be a very strange conversation, but yeah, you'll probably do all right.
Yeah, we'll try not to be too complicated.
Dave, it's been a big month. We've put out a lot of episodes over April. There was the Horror of Fang Rock episode that you did with your mates down there in Melbourne. There was your big day out where you met Jodie Whittaker. We did our top non-fiction episode of The List Makers. And we also put out our third and final prequel, Cold Take, from Star Wars Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah, it's been a very busy month for us. It's going to be even busier in May. But no, a lot of fun episodes. If you haven't heard those, please do check them out. The lads sitting on the couch giving their views on Horror of Fang Rock was a lot of fun to record, and we'll come back to that at the end of the show.
Yes, we will. For reasons.
For reasons.
Dave, shall we rip into the news? We've got a lot to get through this month.
We should. The new series is coming fast, so there is proper news happening.
Yes, and I'm going to kick off with Millie Watch. This is a bit of a long one, but I think it bears looking into, because we have a new Millie Watch, Dave, and isn't this getting interesting? At long last, we've had a barrage of news stories from official sources directly referencing the rumours we've been reporting on from back in January surrounding Millie Gibson leaving Doctor Who. And this would be tops if the response was happening back in maybe early February, but here we are in late April and it's only just starting. It seems it took the team a little while to get their story together. And what I noticed about basically all these news stories, Dave, is they go in with this real attitude of, back in January, the papers said Millie was sacked, and yet here she is. She's going to be in season two. So those awful newspapers, they were wrong. They're always wrong. Even though they're usually always right. And they're basing it off stuff like this RTD quote. And I quote him. He says, "We're heading into season two. And my God, Ruby Sunday is important to that. There's good stuff to come." Or this quote from Millie. "Russell's given me the gift of a really beautiful story arc. Not only in season one, but in season two also." Or this other RTD quote. "Not leaving. Not at all. We were ordered for 2 years of a series off Disney, and we're delivering 2 years, and the Ruby Sunday story literally spans those 2 years." Now, I'll pause there, Dave, to see if you have anything to say. I've got a lot more to say after that.
Only that I'm very, very interested to see how this plays out. We suspect that there's a bit more going on under the surface. We don't actually know that that's the case. We know that RTD and the BBC spin for their lives. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where the truth is. I'm kind of just finding Millie Watch now a really good spectator sport.
Well, here's the thing. The news report that started it all back in January said very clearly that Millie would be in the second season. So RTD and Millie saying, "Look, she's in season two," doesn't actually refute what the rumour was. Everyone's either forgotten what was actually said, or have maybe read second-hand accounts by people who read the original and they didn't understand it, or they rewrote it clumsily for their own blogs, and the nuance of her being in season two was lost. Saying her story spans two seasons doesn't mean she's in all of it. And folks, do remember, the original rumour piece, which people are now saying was wrong, with a, you know, wobble of the head, also broke the news that Virata Sethu would be joining the show, and this was before she was even seen on set. So it clearly had some good sources. And I know you have more to say about Virata in a minute, Dave, so I won't go down that rabbit hole. I'll just say my gut feeling, as we sit here in April 2024, more than a year away before the second season's going to air, is that I think Millie's in maybe half the episodes, but not the whole thing. I feel the quotes being doled out to the media are designed to paper over the cracks for now, because saying she's in season two is perfectly true. And if media outlets take that to mean she's in all of season two and run with that when she actually isn't, then the tactics work. The BBC marketing team's going to be cracking the champers. I think we'll have a better idea come Christmas, because you'd expect, Dave, that if none of this rumour was true, if all of this was just nonsense, then Millie will have to be in the 2024 Christmas episode for starters, right? Because that was one of the things that article said. It said she's not going to be in at Christmas. She's in limited stories in the second season. But hey, I guess the marketing team has 8 months now to come up with a story when we cross that bridge.
Yeah, I think that nothing that's been said in those quotes that you've mentioned there, Rob, is going to prove to be untrue.
Correct.
But also nothing that you read out there contradicts the rumours that have been floating around and that we talked a bit about in February. So is the truth somewhere between there, you know, to go all Vorlon on you, Rob? Your truth is a three-edged sword, your version, my version, and the truth in between. So maybe that's the case here.
Well, that final Russell quote I read out, the one where he's like, you know, the Ruby Sunday story literally spans those 2 years. It's almost like Russell doth protest too much. That's just my take anyway.
Yes, it's going to be fascinating to see what happens. And potentially, as I've said before, to wait 30 years for the tell-all book and find out what really happened.
Exactly.
But we do know, as you said, Rob, that Virata is now official. We've known this for several months. We've had photos of her filming on set. Everybody's known it, but now it is absolutely press release official. To quote from the release, Virata joins the Hooniverse. God, I hate that word. Virata joins the Hooniverse from a galaxy far, far away after starring in the Disney Plus Star Wars series Andor. Now she straps in for another journey through time and space alongside Shuti Gatwa as the 15th Doctor and Millie Gibson as Ruby Sunday. Currently in production, the second season of Doctor Who is set to debut in 2025.
Yes, indeed. And I mean, it's a big deal to come over from Star Wars. It's just unfortunate for Doctor Who that Andor was probably one of the least well-received Star Wars programs. I mean, we adore it. We think it's fantastic Star Wars. But there'll be a lot of people out there who never watched Andor who'll be saying, huh? She's from Star Wars? Really?
Yeah, and it is just again worth noting that we do have this bizarre situation where they've more or less finished filming and well through post-production of season two before season one of Shuti's reign has even started. So we're getting these bizarre announcements about a companion we're not going to see for another year. We've got all the episodes of Millie to go first, and now we know who her replacement is. It's look, I get why it's necessary, and the BBC's between a rock and a hard place in how to do this. We said last month, you know, they can just pretend Virata isn't happening for another year when we all know she is, or they can come out now and acknowledge it and have a bit of a damn squib announcement in some ways, but that's the realities of doing back-to-back seasons.
Exactly, and I think it comes back to, funnily enough, one of the quotes I read during Millie Watch, where RTD said, "We were ordered for 2 years of a series off Disney, and we're delivering 2 years." And I thought, ah, that's interesting. That might tie into why Shuti was talking about maybe only doing 2 years. It wasn't just him. It was maybe the whole production. It was only a two-year deal initially. And to deliver that 2 years, they just had to keep pumping this out. They couldn't have a break in between seasons. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, Shuti is absolutely now in that resume building part of his career. He's had his breakout role. He's then done a couple of things where he's got, you know, a couple of lines sort of off the back of that. As we said, the Barbie movie, Masters of the Air, he's in it. And it's, oh, wow, Shuti Gat was in it. Oh, he's got two lines. Okay. Because that was all sort of before he really was a big deal. Now he's got this worldwide franchise to go. And I'm sure he's champing a bit going, oh, I want to keep building. I'm hot property at the moment. I need to build my reputation while I'm doing that. And I fully expect him to go and do some very serious drama somewhere. And then he's going to do some really high profile dramas, you know, or comedy somewhere, because he's doing what young actors do when they break out.
Yeah, absolutely. Moving on, I've got a quick one here tying into the news that Millie's in season two. There has been a suggestion that her arc, which does start in season one, obviously, will be similar to the Timeless Child arc, from which I take the idea that because Millie's a foundling and doesn't know her parents, she's going to be continuing that search for them, and presumably will eventually find out who she is, and that's going to be her arc. Now, some people are taking RTD's quotes about this to mean Ruby Sunday is an alien, and it ties into the Timeless Child that way. I'm not so sure about that. Others take it to mean that the Doctor will take up the search for his own background too. That's possible, but I'm not sure I see that. I don't think many showrunners pick up other showrunners' ideas and put a definite cap on them. You know, like, hey, Chibbers, you left it ambiguous where the Doctor came from, but I'm going to name the planet and have him meet his parents. I don't see that happening. I see it for Ruby in the sense that she will find out who she is. She'll find out who her parents are. And so there are parallels to the Timeless Child in that sense, but maybe not as deep as fans are suggesting there will be.
Yeah, this article and RTD's quotes within it really gave me the vibes of JNT and, well, you know, of course, there's no reason the Doctor couldn't be a woman and just watch everybody go crazy and write news stories and all the rest of it. No, all RTD needs to do is just say, that Timeless Child, hey? And it's guaranteed to get attention. It's guaranteed to get people worked up and excited. Yes. And if they're worked up and excited, they're talking about the show. They're going to watch the show. It's the easiest piece of bait for a Doctor Who fan now to just go, Timeless Children. We could do something with that.
Yeah.
And just watch them jump.
Exactly. Like I say, I don't think he'd play too much with Chibnall's idea, unless he got Chibnall back to actually write it himself.
Yeah, and let's face it, when we have watched seasons 1 and 2 of Shooties at Rain, are we going to go back to all these quotes and go, well, hang on, you said this? I mean, you know, BBC press releases aren't released under oath, so, you know, who cares?
Exactly.
Up to the moment, Rob, this morning I woke up to notice that British fandom was in chaos. They were in apoplexy because a photo had been released based on the episode of the coming season where we believe that the Doctor will meet the Beatles, where they had put the actors playing the Beatles in that episode into the With the Beatles album cover plus the Doctor and Ruby Sunday. Now, I have 2 points to raise here, Rob. The first is that it's always risky to do something like this because I think the Beatles is to music what Doctor Who is to television. They're from the same era. They're both very British. They're both associated with a certain amount of British culture. But also they're both pieces of ephemera that have been written about in such incredible detail. I mean, we know every minute of every note that was planned in every song the Beatles ever wrote and where they were at any one time and what John Lennon had for lunch when he was doing this. And, you know, it's extraordinary. I mean, it is Doctor Who levels of stuff. So everybody's sitting there going, well, actually, you know, John Lennon didn't have his glasses at that stage. He only got them when he was filming How I Won the War. And, you know, there's that level of just, you know, sort of fan obsession. But the other thing is that I think it's actually quite unfair on the actors to have released stills because it's perfectly reasonable that they're not going to cast people who look exactly like the actors. And look, I'll be honest, I get the uproar because I look at that with the Beatles mock-up they've done and I can't tell which of the four Beatles is meant to be which.
I think Lennon's got the tote glasses. You know, Tote from Raiders of the Lost Ark, the Nazi?
Yes.
And shout out to Dylan Reese for tweeting that earlier.
So look, I mean, they don't, but we're not seeing their performance. We're not seeing them in character. We're not seeing how they act. And I was thinking about it. I'm a huge fan of the movie Nowhere Boy, which came out in 2009. It's about Lennon's life before the Beatles became the Beatles. And in that, Aaron Taylor-Johnson plays John Lennon. Thomas Brodie Sangster plays Paul McCartney. And if you just showed me a still of the two of them, I wouldn't go, oh my God, he looks exactly like John Lennon. Oh my God, he looks exactly like Paul McCartney. But when you see them on screen imbibing those characters, speaking, they portray those characters. They portray that attitude, those personalities, the voices. And I suspect that when we see these actors actually in character, it will be far, far better than just an unfortunate bad still of them. So the outrage and the uproar was hilarious, and I get it, but I think it's probably going to turn out to be a bit unfair.
Oh, so many things to say here, Dave. I mean, I'm obviously a massive Beatles fan as well. I would say the movie Backbeat had very realistic-looking Beatles in it. If anyone knows Backbeat, Backbeat's fabulous, the story of Stuart Sutcliffe and the Beatles in Hamburg. But I'm wondering about this image whether it's actually taken from the episode or whether it's just a mock-up for a bit of publicity. Like, does the Doctor actually record in the show and they put out this record that looks like this and it's a still from the show, or is this just a bit of publicity? I think it's probably the latter. So I'm not getting too uptight about it. I've already been uptight, Dave, on Twitter about things like the stills they've put out earlier where the Abbey Road studio was apparently on the same level as where they record on the floor, and that's not true at all. It was up some stairs, so they've got Abbey Road wrong. The guy playing Macca is holding the bass completely wrong. I've said he holds it like Chris Novoselic from Nirvana. I mean, don't get me started on this, Dave, but yes, this with the Beatles thing, I'm not getting too uptight about because I don't think it's even from the episode. I think it's just some publicity.
No, that was my assumption as well, and it's only when you said that I thought, oh, maybe it actually is a plot point. Look, it's. I think it's going to be a lot of fun, but yes, you have two incredibly detail-focused and, dare I say, anally retentive fandoms at work here.
Massive.
And a lot of overlap between them, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
I've got everything crossed for that episode. I hope it's great, but so much could go wrong.
Yeah, let's just hope. While there's life, there's hope.
Exactly. Should we move on to short topics?
We should, and you're going first, Rob.
Yes. As we get closer to the new series, obviously more news stories, many more news stories are being written. The floodgates are opening. We've seen it in some of the news we covered just a moment ago. And fandom is starting to have its usual turf wars. You know, isn't this terrible? Isn't that fabulous? And so on. But something I've noted, particularly as more of the fringe types throw their toys out of the pram and say, this isn't Doctor Who and that isn't Doctor Who, generally because it's stuff we've never seen before in the show, is the accusation that it's all going to be a big bait and switch this new season one, Dave. You know, RTD is using Doctor Who as a brand to bring people in, then he's going to throw musical numbers or drag queens at them, and that's the bait and switch. But what I'm thinking as we sit here, you know, less than a month out from the series starting, is that, yes, there are these new elements. There is a drag queen who may or may not be the Master. I sense more musical numbers are coming, particularly in that Beatles episode. So, yes, yes, yes. But I'm turning it around in my mind that this is possibly a reverse bait and switch, that RTD has got his eye on the TV landscape and is thinking, maybe even a bit cynically, that for cut-through, I'm going to do this, that, and the other. I'm going to push Doctor Who into new territory on the surface. But when we get down, particularly in our hot takes, and we dissect this series of adventures, I think it's going to be far more like traditional Doctor Who than we might think, and that the fringe elements would ever be willing to admit. It's only a theory, Dave. I might be wrong. We need to see the full series play out first. But that's where I'm sitting with this. I think traditional Doctor Who is coming in a slightly different wrapper.
I think there's probably a lot in that. I think if you're doing a trailer, you obviously put in the bits that are most likely to catch a mainstream audience, most likely to seem different and exciting, and most likely to get publicity and get people talking, as we just discussed. So I think there's a lot of merit in that. Personally, I've now sort of reached that zen point of, look, it's only a few weeks away. There's no point expending a lot of brain power on thinking about what might be, because we're going to know exactly what is pretty soon. So I'm now very chill. I'm now very zen. Whatever will be, and I will just watch it and see what happens.
Fair enough. What about your short topic?
I've watched some Doctor Who this month, Rob.
Oh, there's a surprise.
For reasons I have absolutely no understanding or conception of, I watched Vengeance on Varos and the Planet of Evil. Mm-hmm. Now, I put on Vengeance on Varos, and I've got to say, the first part particularly really, really sucked me in. It's
Jason Connery with no shirt.
I did notice that. It's interesting because, Rob, you can probably remember as well as I can that immediate post-Colin Baker period, and even sort of a little bit of that post-McCoy period when you and I were really involved in fandom and reading fanzines. And the Colin era came in for quite a bit of a kicking from a lot of people in fandom.
Yes.
Nearly as much as the Williams era did back in those days, but, you know, nothing could quite be kicked as much as fans kicked the Williams era back in the 80s. But even amongst all of that, I can remember a lot of the topics, a lot of the views were that Varos was the one Colin story that maybe could be considered a classic. It was sort of the one that people went to and said, oh, that, okay, I didn't like the era, but I liked Vengeance on Varos. And watching it back, I can really see why it did appeal to people, and obviously a lot more people like a lot more of the Colin era now, but it still stands out as quite a good production. The model works good. The script is saying something. There's a couple of bad actors and actresses in there, but otherwise the cast is pretty good. It's got Syl, and Syl is great. I'm not convinced Martin Jarvis quite knows what he's doing, but he at least looks sincere while he's doing it. And that cliffhanger is extraordinarily good. The Greek chorus is extraordinarily good. And at the end of part one, I was really keen to watch part two. I did. I don't think it quite holds up quite as well. I do accept the criticism that all the Doctor really does is survive the story, and it's resolved by economic forces taking hold and, you know, sort of a memo from company, you know, memo from headquarters. Yeah. So I get that. But look, I thought it was a really enjoyable watch. So I'm glad I went back and watched that. I also went back and watched Planet of Evil, which it's at least 10 years since I've watched this, possibly more like 15. It's possibly whenever the DVD came out, I watched it once and haven't again. I watched part one and thought, this isn't too bad. It's got some interesting ideas, but unlike Varos, I wasn't then going, okay, I really want to watch part two now. I really want to watch part three. I do find it a fairly dull sort of story. Some of it looks good. I think the jungle looks good on film, not quite so much on video. The red outline monster is a pretty cool effect for the mid-1970s. I get all that. But as the story goes on, it just gets sillier and sillier and weirder and weirder. All the stuff with Sorensen, and he's got his drink that cures him, and I know they're doing Jekyll and Hyde, but it doesn't really make a lot of sense. And you know, his teeth fall out when he's one, and then they grow back with it when he has the drink. That doesn't work. And you've got Prentice Hancock, and look, I've seen Prentice Hancock give some good performance and stuff in the Chocky TV series. He's really, really good. But I think when he comes into Doctor Who, he just goes somewhere, and in this one he really goes off the reservation and, you know, come on Vyshinsky, give an order, do something, save the ship. And then by the time you get to the point of Prentice Hancock wandering around a very dull set with a very limp sort of prop, waving it as though he's got, you know, a nuclear reactor in his hand and just shouting at shadows, I just thought, is this the low point of the Hinchcliffe era? And I think it might be.
Possibly, yeah.
But it was fun to go back and watch it.
Oh, good. Did you put out a poll for that one, or did you put out a poll for what you've watched after that?
I put out a poll for what to watch after Varos.
Okay.
So Planet of Evil won that.
That was that one. Okay. All right. To round out Short Topics, just briefly, on the back of our list makers about top Doctor Who non-fiction, we've had so many replies to it on social media, people giving their lists, which often had quite a few snaps with us, but also raising other books, and I'd find myself thinking, oh gosh, I've got that book too. Why didn't I think to mention that? And between all of that and just walking past my shelves here at home, can I also suggest some stuff, Dave, like I Am the Doctor, which is Pertwee's final memoir.
Yep.
Black Light, The Art of Andrew Skeletor. Is There Life Outside the Box, which is Davo's autobiography. Red, White and Who, which is all about Doctor Who in America, fandom, that is. Doctor Who Companions, which is pretty self-explanatory. Doctor Who Monsters, self-explanatory. The New Audio Adventures, which is Big Finish in its early days. It's a big hardcover book about all the early audios they made. Even that's only scratching the surface. And then there's some other things that I'm aware of and I think would probably be quite good, but I've never read them, like Nick Courtney's autobiography, Five Rounds Rapid, which was later updated, I believe, as Still Getting Away With It. I don't have either of those, so I can't comment, although I do have the Big Finish memoir, A Soldier in Time. So there's another title to mention, albeit only an audio release there. Dave, Doctor Who non-fiction, it just doesn't bloody stop.
No, I had the same thing you had, Rob, of sort of looking at my list and looking at all the things that could have made it and seeing all the things that listeners suggested. I think we've had more feedback on this list makers than any other. So it's definitely, you know, touched something out there in our listeners. I thought about Bookworm, which is an analysis of the New Adventures. It's really, really fun. The Adrian Riddlesfield Monster book, which I remember really enjoying when I bought as a teenager. The Black Archive books, Rob. There's some really, really good volumes there. And we do need to give a shout out to a friend of the podcast, Matt Barber, and his Black Archive issue on the demons. You know, all those old Haining books, really, really wonderful. And the other thing I realised when I sort of was going to take some publicity shots of my bookshelf for the for Twitter is just how many of these authors you and I know or have met. people like Matt Barber and Hayden Gribble and Dylan Rees, Robert Mamone, just so many people that we've actually had the privilege to meet and have written books that are on our shelves and we really love. And that's just says, it just really proves that point that I made in the Listmakers that when you reach the era where fans are writing books that fans want to read, that's just amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Or even you get to the You and Who books where you and I have written in them, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've met each other, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And we have met each other, yes, yeah, several times. No, it's really good stuff. I really love doing that episode. We could have done twice as much. It did get a huge response. I've loved seeing everyone's pictures of their own bookshelves. The Black Archive started following us on Twitter after that episode. It's been huge, actually.
Fantastic. Well, it's good. Yeah.
Alrighty, Dave, the time's come. Shall we move on to our main topic?
Who killed Kennedy?
Yes, Who Killed Kennedy? We've put the synopsis out as a secondary show. You may have heard it, you may not have. Dave, why don't you kick off by telling us just why you picked this before we get into what it is and all of that stuff?
I picked it for a couple of reasons. One is that it's a very, very unusual piece of Doctor Who fiction. It sits almost aside from everything else. It's not a new adventure. It's not really a missing adventure. It's a standalone book that was made by Virgin at the time. It really lit a spark for me when I read it the first time. I've read it now four, maybe five times over the last 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really sat there with me. And I thought, it's a book I want to talk about because I enjoy it, but it's also a book I want to talk about because of what it says about where fandom was in April of 1996. We're a month away from the telly movie in the New Adventures. Death and Diplomacy has come out, so we're one book away from Happy Endings, the 50th New Adventure. The Eye of the Giant came out as the missing adventure. So we had three books from Virgin that month.
Wow.
But all of fandom is just sitting there waiting to watch the Paul McGann telly movie, not knowing what's going to happen. It was Schrodinger's telly movie at this stage. It could be the start of a great big Fox American Doctor Who series, or it could be that this is the one that is broadcast, flops, and that's it. We had our shot at a comeback, and it's gone, and we've lost the Virgin books because of this. They've lost the license because of this thing. So fandom really was just in this really tense place in April of 1996, and that's, I think, interesting and worthy of exploring.
Definitely. In terms of what the book is, if I had to make an elevator pitch for this, it'd be something like a Kiwi journalist in the UK starts investigating a bunch of news stories, which loosely correlate with the first few seasons of the Pertwee era, and he tries to make sense of it all before getting tied up in an all-new offshoot adventure using characters from the era, written in the style of a conspiracy tell-all sort of memoir rather than a straight fiction story.
Yeah, that's a really great summary. And look, maybe that's the thing we need to just start on when we talk about what this is. This is written in the first person.
Yes.
It's written by journalist James Stevens with the help of author David Bishop, but it's written from the point of view of this fictional journalist, James Stevens, who basically is living in the UK of the Doctor Who universe and is trying to put together all the different things that he's seeing in his life and on the television and in Britain as a first-person conspiracy book. And the way he weaves stuff in is really, really important. But I'm about to go down and start analysing it, Rob. So before we do that, we talk about what it is.
Yeah.
Let's talk about when we each first encountered it.
Well, I was aware of it being a thing. And this is going to surprise you, Dave. I was aware of it being a thing when I started on the EDAs around 1997 because it was still hanging around in sci-fi bookshops at that time. But I didn't stump up for it and I didn't read it. I didn't quite get what it was, I think. And I wasn't curious enough to pick it up. And it's remained that way since, even though it was something I later became more aware of, and I believed it had a good reputation. I sort of got a feel for what it was about, and I had this feeling that it was something just a bit different. But no, I never actually chased it down and read it cover to cover back in the day. I think the few times I saw a copy for sale after some years had gone by, it was already pretty expensive. So it was just one of those scenarios when you're not super duper into something and suddenly it costs a fair whack of change. I just didn't bother with it. So exclusive, Dave, this was my first reading.
Fascinating. Oh, that's really, really interesting. So, look, I was in fandom at this time. I was very heavily involved in fandom at this time. I was just off turning 16 when this book came out. I can remember this turning up on lists of forthcoming titles from Virgin. So they'd say, here's the next batch of new adventures we're doing. Here's the next batch of missing adventures we're doing. And also in April, we're releasing a book called Who Killed Kennedy? And everyone's gone, what's that?
Yeah.
Then the covers come out and it's very clear they could only afford two artwork covers that month because it's got a very, very basic cover, like a very basic cover. And so everyone's looking at that and going, I still don't know what this is. But I can remember stopping off at the bookshop on my way to a local Doctor Who Club meeting at the time and buying it probably a couple of weeks after it came out. And sort of getting into the meeting and saying, oh, I bought this on this way. And a friend of the podcast, Richard, going, that is a very, very cool book. I've just finished it. That is a very cool book. And a couple of others around go, yeah, I've read it as well. That is a very good book. And it just sort of had this really, really strong word of mouth. And I, of course, went home and I read it. And it was an absolute page turner. It is it is written for the dedicated diehard Doctor Who fan, and particularly for somebody who loves the Pertwee era, as I absolutely did growing up and still do. So I have really fond memories of reading it when I was 15 going on 16. I read it probably about 6 months, 12 months later because I was like, I want to read this one again. And then probably every 10 years since, I've pulled it down and gone, oh, I just, you know, might read the first couple of chapters and just remember what it's like and then just keep going because it really gets me in. So it's one of the most read books of that era for me.
Wow. That's... We diverge quite a bit on this. In terms of our background with it, at least.
Yeah, in terms of our background with it, at least. So, who shall go first on their initial thoughts?
Dave, I'll jump in, given that I'm the new boy here.
You are.
There were some times, particularly early on, when I wasn't entirely sure if I was really into it. By which I mean, I wasn't hating it. It was perfectly competent. But all the... Now let's make a reference to or retell scenes from a Pertwee story. Those bits kind of bored me. My brain was like, yes, yes, you're telling this story from a different point of view. Fine. What interested me far more, Dave, was when James Stevens would be at work and dealing with his colleagues or dealing with his boss or just talking about journalism. And being an ex-journalist, I noticed some of the phrases he was using and things he was describing. Or when he got the sack or got the stuffing kicked out of him at his father-in-law's house. All of that stuff had nothing to do with Doctor Who, but I was really engaged with that part of the story, and that's what kept me going. But then we'd end up, say, in The Mind of Evil, and we'd have these cutesy references to almost encourage us to put on the show and try and figure out which background actor he is suggesting James Stevens is meant to be, given James Stevens is in that scene. I get it. It's kind of clever. But those are the scenes I was hoping would end quickly whenever they came up because, yes, yes, I know the story. I know what you're trying to do. Let's get to the next bit. Let's get back to James's life. I was really interested in James's life, not so much the flashbacks of Doctor Who to him, the reality that he's living.
That's really interesting. When I read this as a 15-year-old, all the stuff that you found boring was what absolutely hooked me in. So we'll get to the stuff where he's obviously doing Spearhead from Space and he gets the call from Mullins at the Ashbridge Cottage Hospital. And it's like, he's saying the words that he says on the TV show. That's really, really cool. And then you get to the Silurians and it's, oh, this is all happening. And then, oh, he's the one that made the phone call. You know, the Daily What? How did you get this number? It's like, isn't that really clever? Yeah. And as a nerdy,
I get it.
Yeah, as a nerdy teenage fan, that was the stuff that I absolutely liked. And then as the book sort of, you know, moved further from that and more into the story and stuff with Dodo and stuff with the Doctor, and it's like, you know, doing lots of, you know, how to make babies by doing dirty things. And I'm like, I don't need to know about that. Go back to talking about Doctor Who. That I really sort of felt. Whereas reading it now, a lot older than 15... nearly 30 years older than 15. I still love the cleverness of what's going on. I still love reminiscing the Pertwee era with it. You're right. The journalism stuff is very strong, and I've thought that when I was young, and I think that now. But, yeah, that relationship stuff and that character stuff that actually weaves through in the middle third of the book particularly, I took a lot more out of as an adult than I did as a teenager. And so, yeah, I was probably a little bit less obsessed with the cool wanky fanfic than I was as a kid, but a lot more into the character stuff than I was as a kid.
Oh, yeah, to throw in another example, when they're doing the demons, James Stevens, because he's a Kiwi, he'd be into rugby. The authors picked up on the idea of, oh, in the demons, they mentioned there's going to be some rugby on television, like the unit boys were going to watch the rugby. And he ties all that in. And I can see how it's clever. I can. But yes, as an adult, reading this for the first time, I was much more interested in the real life stuff, so to speak. And that includes the introduction where JFK and Bobby Kennedy are sitting around and nuclear war is about to break out and all of that stuff. It's a teaser that sort of goes nowhere, but I really liked that as well.
Yeah, I can totally get that. And what I also found interesting about reading it again now is just how freaky I found some of the timeline stuff. Because you read the book in 1996, it's meant to have been written in 1996, and it's talking about things that happened about 20 years ago, 20, 25 years ago. And then, you know, when he's talking about stuff that happened in 1971, and he's talking about the assassination of Kennedy, you sort of have to sit there and go, oh, that was only 8 years ago from this character's point of view, and it was only about 30 years ago from the time of the book, whereas now he's sort of going, Kennedy, that was 60 years ago, and, you know, 1996, that was nearly 30 years ago, and sometimes I actually had to sort of almost pause my reading and kind of go into my brain and go, no, remember, it's 1971, it was written in 96, the last 30 years didn't happen, you know. I just had to kind of reset my understanding of how far away things were.
Yeah, I had that exact realization when he's talking about the Kennedy assassination. I'm thinking, oh yeah, he's like one of these conspiracists who we see today, you know, 60 years on. But yes, that realization that it was only 8 years earlier in his timeline, it was like, oh, It was quite a funny moment in my head when I realised that.
So something we've both spoken about, Rob, let's kick on with it, is that first third of the book, which is very, very heavily reliant on weaving into the story all of the events of a number of Doctor Who stories. So it starts off, as we say, he gets involved in the events of Spearhead. He witnesses part of what happens in the Silurians. And then he goes back and he sort of tries to start weaving in all these appearances of the Doctor. And I think there's something incredibly fan-wanky, I'll give it that, but quite clever in the way that he's looked at different events like Remembrance of the Daleks, like the Faceless Ones, like the War Machines, just gone, how would these have looked from the perspective of someone on the street, just an everyday Londoner or a journalist? Do you appreciate the work that went in there, or was it just a bit too saccharine and fan-wanky for you?
No, I agree. It's very clever. And going back into the Troughton stuff and even, you know, a Hartnell story and hanging out with the photographer Isabel and all of that, I quite like that. And I must confess, in the midst of all of this, he does start seeding in new information. Well, to me, new information. I mean, the formation of UNIT he talks about, and that's really interesting on a number of levels, but one of the big revelations he comes out with is that the UK is painted as being not that enamoured with UNIT, and a lot of military people in the UK think the Brigadier is a bit of a loose cannon. He's gone over people's heads to start his own tin pot army, you know. It's a really interesting way to think of how others viewed UNIT, so not just how the man on the street viewed an alien invasion, but how the establishment viewed UNIT, because I've never seen UNIT written about in this way before.
Yeah, and even from the common soldier's point of view, you know, talks about soldiers who say, look, I'd rather go to Belfast in 1971 than be assigned to UNIT. You know, that's just, you know, you sort of sit there and think, yeah, it probably would have got a bit of a reputation that, you know, this is where soldiers go and they don't always come back.
Oh, exactly.
Picking up on what you said there, I liked in here the discipline that I think that Bishop does have in what he picks to weave in, and also which characters he has Stevens interact with. I think that the book would have failed if he'd gone down the path of involving Stevens in stuff that he just wouldn't have been involved with. If there'd been stuff like, I happened to be in Eastchester at the weekend and I saw something going on at this Project Inferno, or, you know, I just happened to go and buy a daffodil from an Auton today. And Bishop is actually quite careful to only have Stevens involved in stuff that Stevens would actually naturally be involved with. And sometimes after the fact, he's like, I got a tip off to go and investigate something that happened or a scandal that happened a while ago. And as an investigative journalist, you go, okay, yeah, he probably would try and get his sources and go back and do them. But then again, you know, who he meets and who he talks to, I think is very clever and very selective. So as you said, of all the people in the invasion that meet and talk to him, it's Isabel Watkins. Because of course she would. She's that sort of a character and she's, you know, trying to make a life. And she's like, well, look, I took some photos and you don't have to believe me, but, you know, whatever it is. And when he's investigating what did happen at Inferno some months after the event, of course he goes and meets Greg Sutton. Because all the English characters are all in government jobs, go, I can't talk to you about that. I'm cut. And Greg Sutton's like, mate, I'm leaving the country. Have a buy me a beer. I'll say whatever you like. Have a chat. Yeah. And you go, yeah, because that's the character that would do it. And so I thought that selectiveness was actually quite disciplined.
Yeah, and also some tongue-in-cheek, like, pictures of Cybermen looking like, you know, blokes in suits and stuff like that. I appreciated that quite a bit.
Yeah, I did. I did as well.
Dave, I've got notes all over the place. I have a column called Good Stuff. Well, I just picked something out of Good Stuff at random.
Go for it.
The dodo bits of the story, Dave. Let's talk about those. I've got no idea how people feel about this, whether they roll their eyes and think it's all a bit forced and cliche and what's Dodo doing in here and, oh my God, they're having sex and they're going to have a kid and, you know, all of this. But I went with it. It felt plausible to me as a continuation of Dodo's story. And initially, I felt really sad as her life had just gone so badly after all this time travel and, you know, being dumped back in the 20th century. But then happy that she gets this life with Stevens, then quite shocked that they... Folks, we are in spoiler territory. They have her killed off. But a bit more on that later. Overall, the dodo bits of the book land in my good stuff column.
I certainly appreciated them a lot more this time than I did, again, when I was a teenager. I can remember very, very vividly that that was quite a controversial part of the book in 1996. And of course, in 1996, a lot of fans probably had barely seen anything of Dodo. They might have seen part four of The Celestial Toymaker on VHS, but that might be it. And all they knew was that she was in The Gunfighters and everyone hated The Gunfighters, and or maybe they've seen the arc with her changing accent. And, you know, it was sort of, she was a bit of a figure of fun. Nobody really knew much about her. And it also unfortunately got conflated with the First Doctor Missing adventure, which had Dodo featured in it, and infamously she slept around and got space syphilis or something. And so there was this sort of feeling of like, oh, well, Dodo's fandom's whipping girl. We could just put her in books and kill her and give her syphilis and all that sort of thing. Mm. And neither book is really like that. And this one certainly isn't. I think it's actually, you're right. We like to think that traveling with the Doctor makes you a better person and is a fun thing to do, but Dodo did get zapped by Votan and did sort of have just sort of get sent off to the country, and clearly she's not had a happy life since. And that really, really was quite shocking for me. But it's worth noting, when you read some stuff the author said about that, he originally wanted Dodo just to be a character like Isabel Watkins that would come in, tell her a little bit of the story, then go. And he said, actually, she's really come into life in my head. Oh, well, maybe she'll stay a bit longer. Oh, now maybe she'll stay a bit longer. And he just found that all flowed very, very naturally for him because the character just got in his head. Like, and I can see that now when I read it.
He does take a little shot at her ever-changing accent in one passage.
He does.
Which I noticed.
I'm going to make the point that this got a lot darker than I remembered a lot quicker. Mm-hmm. I sort of remembered it being about half the novel being very fan-wanky and very fun and just going through the Pertwee era. But actually, it gets dark quite quickly. The affair he has with the red-headed woman that he's set up to sleep with is actually ridiculously early in the book. I thought, wow, okay, that's really quite early. And then he loses Natasha quite early as well. There's all the stuff with her being pregnant and not being pregnant and their relationship, and he gets beaten up. I just thought, this is actually a lot grimmer than I remembered. It's just interesting how much I hooked on to the fan wank and the fun and kind of forgot the darkness, whereas now I read as an adult and go, this is quite grim, perhaps because I can not personally relate. I've never, you know, slept with a prostitute and been blackmailed or anything like that, but I understand adult relationships now.
Sure.
And so these things do resonate in that sense a lot more.
Yeah, yeah. When he did that in the novel, I was thinking, well, this is going to come back to bite him on the ass somewhere. And obviously it does. Continuing on that dark theme, C-19 comes across as really, really, really thuggish, really tough. We're told this is the liaison point between UNIT and the government. And I was trying to reconcile that in my head, like the 1970s UNIT boys working with a crew like this, where if you go investigating UNIT, these thugs come around and beat you up and threaten to kill you. It wasn't feeling realistic to me. I just couldn't reconcile that in my mind. And I was actually really happy later in the novel where we learn that UNIT certainly isn't on board or in cahoots with C-19. That's a whole different thing. Because initially it was just so jarring to me. Yet to Stevens, he's investigating UNIT, C-19 is regularly beating him up or messing yep. his house up. I thought, oh, is this a thing? Like, is this a secret organization that's sort of looking after UNIT? Is that where he's going? I was really surprised by it. It was really thuggish, really dark.
Yeah, only Doctor Who fans could turn a one-line comment from Time Flight into an entire plot thread that goes across not one book, but several books. C-19 actually turns up in a couple of other books, certainly in Gary Russell's Scales of Injustice Missing Adventure.
Oh, really?
Absolutely. So it is actually something that is woven into the Virgin take on the Pertwee years. And it is incredibly mid-90s. It's very sort of government conspiracies. It's, you know, that end of 18 years of Tory government and everybody was just a little bit suspicious of everything. This is when House of Cards was made and To Play the King particularly was made, the sequel to that. You know, you can see these things all coming out of that same era of really just learning to distrust the government. And that idea that the civil service was full of lots of lovely educated gentlemen that put on bowler hats and went to work and ran the country in the best possible way has really now just been dispelled. And people are looking just not just for incompetence, but for conspiracy.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting to hear that because obviously I'm reading this at a completely different age and a completely different time. And yeah, I'm putting that together. That's very interesting.
Continuing on with the character of Stevens and things getting dark, something that struck me reading this now was how young his character was, but also how he's not actually the good guy. I kind of had that Seinfeld revelation, you know, when you get a certain way into Seinfeld and you go, hang on, these are nice people.
No.
And I had that same revelation with this where, again, the first couple of times I read it, it was like this exciting guy, he's older than me and he's a grown adult and he's having wacky adventures in the Doctor Who universe. And now I'm going, he's a 25-year-old kid who's actually a bit of a bastard. And again, that revelation makes it so much more interesting. But it just changes the whole take of the novel. And it means that he's not a Mary Sue, which I think is important.
No, not at all. And perception, as they say, is everything. Your perception of him as your 15, 16-year-old self is so different to what you're having now. Whereas I guess for me, I'm just seeing him as a kid, as a junior sort of journalist and thinking maybe back to my time at that age and what I was like and all of that stuff. So I've never had the reverse of that, but I can see totally where you're coming from. Yeah.
Yeah.
Looking down my list, I've got an interesting unresolved here, Dave. Barbara and Ian are described as going missing at the same time as a 15-year-old girl they were off to meet. That sounds really fishy, doesn't it? And then Stevens describes Ian and Barbara returning to the UK and becoming well-known educators, but he doesn't ever go near the fact that the 15-year-old girl is still missing. I mean, how would that play out in reality? Surely they would be suspects. Even a par or two of them being investigated, I think, would suit this kind of book, but it's kind of brushed over. He sort of introduces it into the text and sort of then just marvels at their knowledge as educators rather than speculate over the missing girl who they went to meet and who's never been found again. That seemed like a missed opportunity and something an investigative journalist wouldn't actually have brushed over.
It's interesting you say that because I had a similar moment of thought when I read it this time. I think he does try to get away with it because he does have that stuff about how investigations into the girl found that she'd actually never existed. There was no record of her. When they went to her registered address, they found a junkyard. And so I think they were sort of trying to paint it as maybe the teachers were victims of something and the girl was, you know, something a bit more sinister. And that's maybe how he's trying to get away with it. But I agree, it doesn't quite work that way.
Yeah, just a random thought I had.
I think it's probably worth at this point looking at the structure of the book.
Yeah.
It's very obvious to me reading it, but also, again, reading interviews after the fact with David Bishop as the author, that he made a pitch to Virgin, said, I want to do this book, and they've gone, that's a really cool idea. Go write us 30,000 words or whatever it is, and then we'll have a look at it. And he's written the first 30,000 words and researched, and it's fun, it's clever, and it's inventive, and it's doing what he wants it to do. And Virgin, you know, Rebecca Levine goes, great, sold. Go write the rest of the book. And then he's gone, bugger, I need a plot now. and you can feel the book twisting a bit to go, right, I can't just spend the entire book walking happily through the Pertwee years and just doing lots of fan-wank-heavy continuity.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to have the plot go somewhere. And the middle third of the book, he does the stuff where the glass house is introduced, the master's introduced, Dodo's introduced, and that kind of works. And then he said he remembers meeting with Rebecca Levine, the editor, and going, so how do you think we should finish this? And she's sort of like, well, maybe some stuff with the doctor, and what do you think? And he's like, look, I've spent so much time seeding this JFK stuff, I've kind of got to go back to 1963, don't I? And she's like, yeah, you probably do. And, but you can sort of feel an author getting to that last third, particularly that last quarter, and maybe just going, I actually didn't have an ending in mind, and let's just do this. I guess this guy killed Kennedy. How did you find the whole ending and that back end?
Yeah, it felt a little strange. I mean, I have only read it the once, so it's just my first impressions of it. That's all I have. I mean, he introduces the character of Cleary at UNIT. And this is actually a bit sloppy in some ways because they're Cleary letters home. And that this is how we get to know Cleary, who will eventually be, you know, wrestling with Lee Harvey Oswald in Dallas. The first one, and this is why I say it's sloppy, the first one says he can't tell his mum where he's stationed or else it's going to be edited out. But then he goes on to name personnel by name in unit rather than just our sergeant. He says Sergeant Benton, for example. And in later letters, he talks about jobs he's been on, names more personnel, talks about experiments he's been subjected to, and none of this is being edited out. I understand it's part of the plot that we're trying to learn who Cleary is and all that, but the information I don't think would be allowed to exist in these letters. And then we get to that one where he writes it after the demons, where it's all just uppercase and lowercase, and he's saying really mad stuff. I don't see that going through the unit censor at all. So I felt like, okay, this is kind of part of the plot, but it doesn't feel realistic. When Cleary has escaped, meanwhile, and he writes to his mother again about his mission that he's now on, that becomes quite chilling and scary. That's something that wouldn't have been edited. So long story short, I would have redacted more of the unit-based letters for a bit more realism when we're introducing Cleary. I may have gone down on a little side street here, but I think we need to talk about Cleary. What did you think about that? That he says his letters are being edited, but they're clearly not?
Yeah, I think that's a real benefit to the book that there is that extra voice in there and that extra perspective in there, and that they do stick with that first person narrative even when the first person switches to Cleary. I agree. I did read them and sort of thought, well, you're kind of lampshading what it says by saying, I can't talk about this, and then going and talking about it anyway.
Yes.
And I think that had he censored too much of it, it would have just been a frustrating read. So he's probably damned if he doesn't. Yeah, particularly that demons letter that he writes. It's a really good idea, and I can see what the author's trying to do by just showing the sort of the slow deterioration of this guy. You know, he kills someone for the first time, and he sees aliens for the first time, and his mate's killed, and you know, then he sees the devil, and you know, he's just completely and utterly screwed in the head. I get that, but conveying that in letters probably doesn't quite work.
Yeah. Also under my sloppy heading in here in my notes, the escape with Cleary from the glasshouse. Stevens and Cleary have just met, and Stevens is like, we should escape. And Cleary's like, yeah, sure. You know, he didn't want to have a crack at that escape before he met Stevens. It's very strange. And the way he dispatches people at the glasshouse, like literally smashing that nurse's face into the floor. until it's just all mangled and she's dead. It gives the impression that unit operatives are killers, but again, I'm not sure how that gels with, you know, Action by Havoc, you know, and the 1970s sort of feel-good unit that we saw on screen.
Yeah, I think this is reflective of the fact that it is from the Virgin era of Doctor Who, where
things
were too broad and too deep for the screen, and there was that consistent idea through a lot of the Pertwee novels to make unit a little bit more grittier than Action by Havoc and make the Brigadier a little bit more vicious, not in a nasty way, but just, you know, more cold-blooded than he perhaps was on television. And so I think it is very reflective of that era. And you're right, reading all that stuff outside the context of the Virgin era probably does seem a little bit weird. Yeah, and even the Master, maybe we go on to the Master now, is again a depiction that doesn't really sit particularly well with the Delgado performance on screen, but does sit very well with the, well, we're telling a book now and the only people reading it are adults and fans, so let's go a bit nastier and let's make the Master a little bit more cunning, a little bit more vicious and all of that sort of thing. So I think that works well. I quite like most of the Master in this. Again, I don't think he quite works in that last few chapters back in 63. I don't think anything in that 63 part works particularly well. But again, I like the cleverness of, okay, well, the Master's captured. And we get a little bit of his trial mentioned in the Malcolm Hulk novelization of the Sea Devils, but it does talk about, you know, okay, they've captured this guy. What does the British public think? Oh, we'll call him a terrorist. And then the government says, oh, you know all those mistakes we made over the last couple of years? It was all him.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a really clever, cynical but clever way of sort of like, oh, he's responsible for the stuff at Wenley Moore. Now, we as fans know that he wasn't, but the government is going, oh, yeah, we didn't stuff up all those secret research centres. It was this terrorist guy. It was all him. and even, you know, going into the detail, I think, Rob, his journalism background, both the author and the character's backgrounds come into this where, you know, the government's buying off media support with exclusives and photos and all that sort of thing. I thought it was really quite cynical but quite clever and helped to take the book beyond just being fan-wank.
Yeah. Well, I've got a comment on the Master here. I jotted down the subheading, "The moment I thought I twigged." And it's when that first phone call from the man with the silky smooth voice comes through and my brain went, this is probably the Master. And then the next moment I thought, ah, the Master killed Kennedy. That's where it's going. Or maybe not. Maybe the Master's involved in killing Kennedy. And so, although that very first thought was off, that the Master killed Kennedy, the second thought was actually on the money, that this would turn into a Master plot line in the end. So I was quite proud of myself when that happened.
Yeah, I think it is seated quite nicely that you can suspect and then get the revelation. You can go, oh, I worked it out. That's awesome.
Yes. Yes, and that's always a good thing in any book like this, yeah. Going back to my good stuff column, Dave, I do want to mention that when Stevens goes back to the glass house after he and Cleary have escaped, and he's got Cleary in the TV studio, you just know it's going to go wrong. You just know the place is going to be deserted. You just know Cleary might say something stupid on TV. And yet, even when all of that happens, it's really exciting. I found that a really compelling part of the story. You know, as they go up to the door of the glass house and they're going to go in on live TV and all of this. I really enjoyed that section.
It's real horror story stuff of, you know, you're shouting at the screen, don't go in there, call the police. you know, and you know, the tension comes from knowing that they're going to do that anyway. And exactly what you say, you're sitting there going, I know where this is going. I know what this trope is. Stop, don't do it, James. And yeah, he goes and does it anyway. And you know, I think that just shows how real James feels as a character. And as much as he's a bastard, and as much as he's quite unscrupulous in a number of ways, he's also the character we've really got to know. And so you really do just feel for him as his life slowly just completely unravels at that point.
Yeah, well, you know what he has gone through was actually real. He was at the glass house. They did really escape. It wasn't a fantasy. And you want to see something that's real be recognized. And it's not. And he looks like a fraud. And, you know, it's a situation you'd never want yourself to be in. If you'd experienced something and you went on TV and said, I have experienced this, and everyone said you were a fraud, and it was kind of proven that you were a fraud, you'd just feel terrible, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a bigger example of what we see throughout the book. Isabel Watkins, Greg Sutton, Liz Shaw, they're all characters that, you know, particularly Watkins, she's like, I saw aliens. Everyone's like, no, you don't. She's like, yes, I did. They're like, well, no, you don't. And you're crazy and you're blackballed. You're not working in the industry anymore.
Mm.
Isabel did nothing wrong. She was a great character. We all loved Isabel. But in real life, if she's going around going, hey, here's some photos of some aliens I met, she's not getting work in mainstream journalism.
Exactly. Yeah.
We haven't talked about a very important character in Doctor Who, and that is the Doctor. I can remember discussing this book probably a couple of years after it came out. I think maybe when I was doing the reread and we were discussing with some friends. And again, friend of the podcast, Richard, did say, oh, that was a great book until the Doctor turns up. I get what he was saying. I don't think it's quite the case. I like the way the Doctor's portrayed in here because it's the Doctor as seen from a third party's perspective, from another person's perspective. He's this weird, enigmatic guy that just turns up, is involved in all sorts of dodgy stuff where lots of people die and then disappears again. And if you just bumped into the Pertwee Doctor in the middle of the Day of the Daleks, he probably would seem like a bit of a dismissive bastard. Mm-hmm. And I think the way that Pertwee is portrayed in that sense and almost is sort of, you know, you see the insufferable side of him, I think he's actually quite good. And I do like the way he's portrayed there.
Yeah, and although that's a scene, the Day of the Daleks bit, where Stevens is actually interacting with Pertwee in real life, I think the more meaningful conversation they have happens over the telephone.
Yeah.
And it just sort of removes him a bit. And I think that's a really clever way to do it. I really actually enjoyed that the Doctor was like one step removed. He's not going to bother meeting with Stevens. He's just going to give him a call. You know, he's just this guy. You know, he's going to give him a bit of advice and that's it. That does change, of course, when we get to the special edition, which I'm sure we'll discuss before we end this conversation. But just on the Pertwee Doctor, I thought it was very well handled. So I kind of disagree with Richard in that respect. I think they did it respectfully and sparingly.
Which Doctor do you think turned up at Dodo's funeral?
Troughton.
I think so too, but it could be McCoy.
Okay, yeah, you're right, actually, but I just went for Troughton.
It certainly, the first part of it where he just turns up and he's a bit dishevelled, and I sort of thought, oh, that's Troughton, not long after saying goodbye to Dodo. But when he starts, he almost gives a remembrance of the Daleks type speech where he's talking about the decisions in life and the deaths it causes. I thought, oh, that's very McCoy. And McCoy was the current Doctor at the time.
Yeah, you're quite right. I had not considered that at all. Possibly McCoy.
I also just want to mention a few of the cool little shout-outs that we get all along the book. We mentioned in the summary people like Ralph Cornish and Professor Kettlewell, Frederick Masters, you know, all these sort of little characters that are players in the Doctor Who universe, but we just get to see a little bit of them. And, yep, sometimes it's a little bit too much, but I just thought it's really, really clever. And even when we get towards the end of the book and Stevens is talking about how he became a lecturer in journalism and he mentored people like Sarah Jane Smith and Ruby Duvall, who is a character in the New Adventure Iceberg. I just thought it was really cool and I enjoyed all that.
Yeah, obviously I don't know Ruby Duvall at all, but for people, it's like the recent Fallout TV series. You can watch Fallout as a big devotee of the IP and you get all the deep cuts, but you can watch it as a complete newbie like my work bestie did, and you still get the story, you don't get the deep cuts.
Absolutely. Now, Rob, unfortunately, the book does have to have an ending. It can't just be fan-made the whole way.
Yeah.
And so we do have to sort of reach a point of Stevens finds out what's going on, he meets the Doctor, and that is at the point of Day of the Daleks in the TV continuity. I was thinking what a shame it was the book couldn't keep going. We could have had stuff like the Green Death, Invasion of the Dinosaurs. How cool would that have been? Yeah. Robot, Terror of the Zygons. And Bishop has said that, you know, had Virgin kept the license, he was interested in doing some sort of sequel follow-up, but it never happened. But sometime after he wrote it, he did put the book up online and did write an alternate ending.
He did, Dave. The special edition. This is the special edition you can get through the New Zealand Doctor Who fan club website that I actually put out to listeners on Twitter about a week before this went out, which has an all-new ending where rather than going back in time as an old man to kill Kennedy, Stevens gets in touch with the Capaldi Doctor and wants to change time and ensure Dodo lives. And it takes some effort, but eventually they arrive at a solution where the old him uses the time ring to go back in time after Capaldi's tweaked it, providing the young him with a manuscript to confirm his identity, warn him about Dodo's death. Then the younger Stevens saves Dodo by killing Cleary. The older Stevens, if I have this right, then shows up at the house and, knowing the time ring will malfunction if it's used again, zaps himself and Cleary's corpse off into the vortex, never to be seen again, allowing the younger Stevens to have a slightly less messed up life going forward and with Dodo. And with no Cleary, Oswald will be the one who shoots Kennedy, and history, as we've known it, will still happen.
Yes, it's that classic sci-fi thing of the old person basically sacrifices their life to ensure that his younger self can live on a much better timeline and a much better path.
Although you've got to live through that life knowing what your future is.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So,
did you like it?
I can definitely see the author regretting what he did to Dodo and going, I need to go back and change that. And mm-hmm. and that's interesting. I don't think that was necessary. But yes, look, as much as I'm not sure if it needed the retrospective lovey-dovey ending, it's all worth it for just having Stevens interact with Capaldi's doctor and just try to explain to this guy, sort of, you know, 500 years in his future, who this guy is. You remember me? We spoke last week. No, that was 500 years ago. Was really funny.
Yeah, I kind of recoil a bit from the happier Dodo lives aspect, as I did actually like that bleaker who killed Kennedy. Well, it was me.
Yeah.
sort of ending. And just in terms of the shooting itself, the original story where Stevens misses with Oswald's rifle and someone else shoots from the grassy knoll made more historical sense, because now, to my mind, no one would be on the grassy knoll, presumably because the older Stevens never went back to that location to shoot from there, and Oswald carried out the mission. So now Oswald is the lone gunman, presumably, but that's not really accurate unless we believe in things like the magic bullet and so on. But this isn't a JFK assassination podcast, Dave, so I'll stop there before I get wound up.
Yes, no, and look, Bishop is quite honest that he just sort of did a bit of hand-wavy, like, oh, the timelines will sort themselves out, it's all okay. And, you know, that's what happens when you go back and change the ending of your novel 30 years later.
Yeah, how about a summary and a score? Do you want to go first?
Look, I obviously am a huge fan of this book. I was a fan of it back in my youth. I'm a fan of it now. I think that it does have a lot of fan wake, but it's just so fun and enjoyable and cleverly done. I appreciated the plot even more when I read it this time many, many years later. I just think it's a lovely thing to have as a standalone novel. I enjoyed it. It's very readable. It's a favourite book of mine. It's an A for me.
Okay. I quite liked this by the time it was done. As I said earlier in our piece here, I was initially put off by all the rips from existing Doctor Who stories. And I get that's part of the vibe of the thing, so maybe saying that even sounds stupid to people listening who really like that aspect. But I genuinely did enjoy the other aspects of Stephen's life more than the Doctor Who stuff. And when he finally gets into his own adventure and is interacting with the Doctor over the phone and taking the time ring back to Dallas, and the Master set him up to either help him, i.e. the Master, or be the one to kill Kennedy, that was like a really, oh, wow, sort of moment. All of that new story that happens towards the end, I think, is really great. And then, as I was talking about, when he actually misses with Oswald's rifle, I'm thinking, well, how's this going to play out? So I think it got really good and interesting, and I really got into it. And yeah, I liked it. I don't think it needed the new ending, though. Although, as you say, it was interesting to have Capaldi turn up. I would toss an 8 out of 10 at this quite happily.
Very, very reasonable. So, listeners, I hope you've appreciated our chat. If you are inspired to go and read the book, it is available here and there on eBay, but there is an online version on the New Zealand fan website. A Google for Who Killed Kennedy New Zealand will probably get you there, but we will also send out the link again, probably on social media.
Definitely. All right, Dave, that brings us to the part of the show where we read emails from our listeners, and I've got one here from Peter Dedman. He says, "Hi guys, just listened to your recent monthly episode about changing the course of Doctor Who history, and I think the most important one was missed. Granted, it's also been talked about a lot and been discussed most widely, the recasting of William Hartnell. Looking back, we can see that the regeneration concept was a masterstroke, which allowed the show to renew itself and change with the times by putting new actors into the role. But what if it didn't happen and they recast William Hartnell with a new Doctor, but an older gentleman who was playing the same version of the character. I think the key result would be a stagnation of the show, which must have been their fear in 1966. How long could you have had someone playing the same character and writing the same stories for them before it became too samey? Even if you made it through the 1960s, would it have survived the 1970s? The 80s? I don't think so. Likely, they would have had to have had a different character take the role of the Doctor by contrived means of being a grandson or something, which would have been unsatisfying and strange. I think the main result would have seen the show cancelled before 10 years were up, and it would have faded away, remembered as a 1960s show. But maybe I'm wrong. Cheers from Peter Dedman.
Thank you for that, Peter. I agree with everything you've said there. It is a really interesting sliding door moment for the show. And let's face it, if you don't get Trout and Pertwee and Tom Baker, you just get people trying to do, you know, an impression of William Hartnell. You're right, the show, I mean, you say 10 years, I don't think it gets to 5.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
In response to our listmakers on top 5 non-fiction books, we have an email from the previously mentioned Richard Nolan.
Yes.
Hi, Rob and Dave. Top 5 reference books. Interesting idea, as there's a lot to choose from. Guessing a few of the classics will be in both lists, though. If you feel like reading this out, below are my choices. Number 5, The 60s by Howe, Stammers and Walker. I feel like this one kind of has to be on the list. This was really the book Who fans have been waiting for, and I think it's fair to say The 60s and its 2 companion volumes totally changed Doctor Who writing and reference works, and set the standard for the more in-depth books that have followed in the last 30 years.
Absolutely.
4. Canine and Other Mechanical Creatures / The Dalek Special by Terence Dicks and Terry Nation. These 2 books are very basic these days, but as a 9-year-old who was obsessed with the show, they were great. For me, the best parts were the pictures of the early Dalek stories, 60 Cybermen and other monsters I only knew from the Target books, or trying to imagine what things like the Chumblies or the Mechanoids were. I think the photos in the Canine book were basically all I knew about Galaxy 4 for years. I remember carefully making the model Dalek and Canine from photocopies done on craft paper, which lived on my bookshelf for years afterwards next to my show bag TARDIS.
Nice.
Number 3, Howe's Transcendental Toy Box by David J. Howe and Arnold T. Blumberg. For those of us interested in merchandise and collecting, this book was a godsend. Crammed with details of 35 years worth of mass market and obscure Doctor Who merchandise from around the world, this must have been a nightmare to compile, but sent many a fan rushing to catalogue their collections, only to then inundate poor David Howe with details and pictures of all the items he hadn't covered, so the second edition was even bigger. A lot of the content since moved online, but my copy still regularly finds its way off the shelf 25 years later.
I do have a copy of that. There's another reference book I've never mentioned.
Number 2, The Second Doctor Who Monster Book and The Doctor Who Monster Book by Terence Dix. Another pair from my childhood, and again, so incredibly cheesy when read now, but great for a young fan. The second volume was my first book about Doctor Who, and the Tom Baker stories being shown on TV, although I realised the ABC never seemed to show 2 stories called The Brain of Morbius and The Deadly Assassin for some reason. Mm. I acquired the first book shortly afterwards from a friend, okay, and like the Canon and Dalek books, was entranced by the low-quality images of Zabi, Yeti, Sensorites, and more.
Yes.
Number 1, The Program Guide, Volume 1 and 2 by Jean-Marc Lefussier. There have been more detailed and more comprehensive books in the years since, including updated editions of these very volumes, but these little red and blue books were landmark publications, being the first widely available episode and cast listings, and those all-important story synopses for when you didn't have a video or Target novel. My copies were read again and again until the first book started to come apart, and I still use my copy of the updated 90s edition on occasion. I believe we have Terence Dicks to thank for ensuring these saw publication, which is just another reason to love him.
Yeah.
Honourable mention, Cybermen by David Banks. This in some ways predates the 60s, in terms of the marked uptick in quality over contemporary books. It's only just a reference book, as there's a fair slice of fiction in there as well, but Cybermen is full of detail about the TV stories and extended universe appearances, although the hardback predates Silver Nemesis and is also thus obviously written before the discovery of Tomb of the Cybermen. Andrew Skillet's lovely 4-colour plates add to the quality feel. Sadly, I don't think they've ever released these as prints or posters. Second honourable mention, the technical manual by Mark Harris, the first and probably only Doctor Who book I saw advertised on TV and an early part of my collection. I remember rushing to the nearby shopping centre the next day after school to grab this for the princely sum of $8.95. For 1983, the technical manual had some great images, and copies of several of them, particularly the Cybermen, wound up on school book covers and elsewhere for years afterwards. I still get my copy out every now and then, just for old time's sake. Keep punching, Richard.
Wow, what a letter there. And yeah, look, I agree with so many of these. I mean, you and I both picked some of these books in our own lists.
We did.
In the list makers. And yes, the technical manual was advertised on TV. I can almost remember the ad in my mind's eye.
Me too.
You know, and I don't think I ever have seen a Doctor Who book advertised on television before. This was on the ABC, folks. And I think my copy of the technical manual even has an ABC logo in the corner. Does that sound right?
Yes, I think they were printed locally and and distributed by the ABC. So yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah, good stuff. Finally, I'm going to read an email from John Shaw. He says, "Hi, Rob and Dave. I have a worry the BBC has dropped the ball with the transition times of New Who, or do they just not care as long as the Mouse House is splashing the cash? Here in the UK, we will have the option to wait until 5:45-ish on the Saturday night to watch the free-to-air 1080p with 5.1 sound if we are lucky. Failing that, there's the iPlayer with its 720p streams, or I can fire up a VPN and log into Disney Plus and watch the new Kilted Doctor in all his 2160p or 4K HDR splendor, accompanied by a rousing Dolby Digital Plus surround sound experience. What to choose? No brainer, I will be VPNing it all the way. But what will this do to the show's UK ratings? I won't be the only techie type who loves their show and their AV equipment. Even the home media releases are suffering this inequality. The release in the UK of the 60th and Christmas specials were DVD and Blu-ray only. UHD 4K Blu-ray was unfortunately missing in action. I fear Shudi Gatwa's ratings will suffer in the UK, and the BBC will once again think of cutting their massive profits off to spite their faces yet again. Take care, guys, and always keep up the brilliant work. Sundays are not the same without a bit of Aussie Who chat. All the best from John Shaw. P.S. I am loving the Star Wars Alternate Galaxies shows. Here is what happened to me at the midnight premiere in Glasgow's Springfield Quay with Attack of the Clones. I had been working from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. and went straight out to meet the lads, so I was a bit tired, and that got the better of me as I fell asleep during the politics bit. Sorry, Dave. But I was awoken with a start when the crowd erupted in anger as whoever had loaded the reels had done so in the wrong order, and a third of the way through, the film jumped to the final third. There was much wailing and gnashing of teeth, fans crying, sometimes for their mummies, and staff subtly removing their name badges. Oh my God. A group demanded the film be restarted from the start, and the police were called a short time later. Can you imagine this, Dave, in Glasgow?
I can, absolutely.
Yeah. We decided to get out of there before the carnage got any worse, popped into the box office the next day, and got unlimited use of the cinema for 3 months. Result.
Wow. Thank you for that, John. Look, I think that's a really interesting take on the whole distribution of the new series. And I'm interested to see what John thinks after it's all sort of happened and how it all worked out for him. So do give us an update at some point, please, John, on what you thought after the fact. And yeah, look, that's just a wonderful story about Star Wars in Glasgow.
I've got to say, I am absolutely not as techy as John. I mean, that's terrible, isn't it? I'm an ex-IT journalist. I'm an ex-tech journalist, Dave, and I'm not as into this stuff. But just looking at all these different ways it's going out, like on the iPlayer, it's 720p. On TV, it's 1080p, but on Disney Plus, it's 4K. You know, it's like, oh, really? I have not considered this stuff at all.
No, me either. So that was a very interesting perspective.
Yeah. How about what we've been watching, Dave?
Look, I haven't been watching a lot. I've been quite busy. Obviously, I watched a little bit of Doctor Who for sort of, you know, chill time. I've been going back and watching some very old Law and Order episodes. I've actually gone back to season one in 1990. And that's so much the same show in some ways, but just so different.
Yeah.
You know, it's quite interesting to see. I'm also working my way through Star Trek Discovery and listening to Trek This Out's hot takes. If you're also watching Star Trek Discovery, I do recommend Trek This Out. They are doing some quite fun hot takes, and I do try and write in with my thoughts. It's fun sometimes to just be a listener.
Mm-hmm.
But that's been it for me.
I've watched a lot of things, but mainly Fallout, Three Body Problem, and Rebel Moon. And there are some great shows here, Dave. Firstly, Fallout is an IP I've loved before there even was a Fallout. Basically, I played the game Spiritual Forebear in the late 80s, so when Fallout came along in the 90s, it was love at first sight for me, has been ever since. And rarely for a Hollywood take on something, whether a book, game, comic, whatever, Amazon didn't mess this up. They stayed true to the world. It's really great. As I said, I've watched Three Body Problem on Netflix, which I first wanted to watch when it dropped some weeks ago, but my wife got this idea that she wanted to read the trilogy of novels first. These are in English, translated from the original Chinese. So I waited for her to do that before I watched it. And different to Fallout, there have been quite a few changes from the books, I'm told. You know, she'll say to me, "See that Mexican woman in the book? That's a Chinese man," you know. So a lot of characters who are Chinese in the novels, which is understandable given it's a Chinese novel, are now sort of multiracial types in the UK where a lot of the action is set. But there's still a lot of Chinese characters and a lot of scenes set in China, particularly in the past. It's not like they blew away the base story completely. It's a very slow burn, but I found it very watchable, very cool sci-fi. Just don't tell my wife there's a 30-episode full-on Chinese version that's dropped in China. Otherwise, she'll be seeking that out and making me watch that. And finally, Rebel Moon 2, The Scargiver. A real mixed bag here, Dave. We've had the setup in the first film of putting this band together, basically the Magnificent Seven. So this is basically the big fight they've all come together for. It's the defense of the village. But first we have to have half an hour of farming, and a lot of it's in slow motion. People break up wheat grains on the palm of their hand and blow them into the breeze, and they swing scythes, and it's all in slow motion because this is a Zack Snyder film after all. Of course it's in slow motion. The finale then is good. It's just a big shootout, basically, where it ratchets up the tension and the stakes progress. There are some good scenes, especially once we get up into the capital ship hovering over the world and a fight breaks out on the capital ship. The villain, I think, is really good in Rebel Moon, but I'll say this. I just don't care about any of the good guys in this. We've been with them for two movies now, and there's even a segment in this film where they sit around a table and tell their sob stories about their pasts, which I think is meant to make us care about them, and nothing. Couldn't care a jot. So they mostly fight solo at the end of the film too, so it's not even like they're fighting like a team. It's weird, really weird. Moments of spectacle, but just this numb sort of feeling that none of it matters. And that's my thoughts on Rebel Moon.
Fair enough. Of those three, the one that I am quite interested in watching is Fallout. And a number of people have told me that even if you've never played the game, which I definitely haven't, you can absolutely follow it. You just might not quite get all the, you know, the deep cut references. But yes. I will try and check that out.
Yeah, please do. I'd be really keen to hear what you think.
So that's our conversation for this month. Rob, next month we will be well and truly into our hot takes on the brand new series of Doctor Who starring TV's Shuri Gatwa.
Isn't that bizarre?
It is, isn't it?
Yeah, wow, okay.
And to break that up with a slightly lighter and hopefully fun monthly episode at the end of May, we are doing a topic we're calling Movie Remakes, where we're going to pick a bunch of Doctor Who stories and say who we would like to remake them as movies. So to give just an off-the-top-of-my-head example, we want to see Steven Spielberg's Curse of Frederick and why and what that would be like.
Yeah.
So a bit of fun there. We both love our movies. I know a lot of people who listen to us do as well, and we'll be doing that. We'll obviously be doing our hot takes. Now, Rob, we mentioned at the start of the episode that a couple of weeks ago when the Blu-ray of season 15 arrived in Australia, I reached out to my friends Richard and Mark from Spacefall and 42 to Doomsday, and I said, guys, we all love horror fang rock, and they've done a remastered version with new special effects. Why don't you come round, have a couple of drinks, and we'll just watch it on the couch together? And they said, that's a great idea, and we did, and we had a great time, and we thought, let's just turn the mic on and record 25, 30 minutes of our reactions to watching this story again, just between friends. And we had a lot of fun doing that. We've had some really good reaction to it. So we've said, look, we're not going to make this a regular segment. We certainly haven't got the time to get around and have a night out watching Doctor Who every month. But we are keen to do it again every so often as an irregular segment. We have decided to give it the title Gin and Tartars.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And if you have listened to our horror fang rock reaction, you'll know at the end of it we joked and said, why not go and test ourselves by watching Underworld, which did spark Richard to issue the challenge and said, okay, guys, while we're waiting for another Blu-ray release to drop, and we'll probably watch something from the next box set when it drops, let's watch something that we really all dislike. And see how that goes down and react to that. And then Mark said, well, let's do one of your Doctor Who show polls, Dave. Let's do a poll. Mm-hmm. So we've decided we are going to do this. We don't know whether we'll record this in May or June, but whenever we can, we will. But we have each made a nomination. Rob, I've asked you to make one as well.
Yes.
We did agree on some rules, though. We said it must be classic. It must be no more than four episodes because we're not watching The Monster of Peladon. And it had to all exist just because, you know, we need to give ourselves some chance of making it to the end.
Mm-hmm.
So, listeners, you get to vote on what we watch on the couch. I have nominated The Space Museum.
Okay.
Mark has nominated The Twin Dilemma.
Yes.
Richard has nominated Delta and the Bannerman.
Mm-hmm.
And Rob has nominated...
Thankfully, I haven't snapped with any of those. I am nominating Nightmare of Eden.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Okay, well, look, that poll will be up in a couple of days' time. And as I say, when we get the chance, we will sit down and watch whatever you vote for. And remember, it's not about being the best or the worst. It's what you think will be most interesting.
Definitely. But until then, I've been Rob.
And I've been Dave.
And we'll see you again on many hot takes and all sorts of good stuff in the month ahead.
Now that we know who killed Kennedy.
Indeed. Or do we?
Or do
we? There's two endings. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to
The Doctor Who Show with Rob and Dave.
Find us online by searching for
The Doctor Who Show.
We also love it when you write in. Drop us a line anytime at hello@thedwshow.net.